So we begin this final session of the Gean's Lectures. What I wanted to do today is to have a very informal time of conversation. So we're going to be having just a very free-flowing conversation about some of the things that we have been hearing about over the past several days with Professor Joseph Pierce. Of course, as all of you know, who have been present at the lectures this week, is professor at Ave Maria University. He is the author of many, many works on Chesterton, on Lewis, on Tolkien, on Solzhenitsyn, other works, and is very widely known for his writings in these areas. He's been speaking to us about issues of narrative, mythology, particularly in Tolkien and also in Lewis. Also have with us on the panel Professor Jim Parker, that most of us in this room are very familiar with Professor Parker, who is professor of worldview and culture, apologetics. He's also associate dean of the Worldview and Culture Division in the School of Theology here at Southern Seminary. And we also have Professor Jim Orrick, who is professor of literature at Boyce College, who is going to be dialoguing with us as well. And so I'm going to give you an opportunity to direct the conversation and to ask questions in a few moments. I'm going to start our conversation. And gentlemen, we're not going to have any established rules here. You come in as you would like to come in. I'd like to start things off, Professor Pierce, by talking a little bit about mythology. And you were talking yesterday about how paganism is in many ways closer to Christianity than secularism. And I know this is something that C.S. Lewis talked about quite a bit as well, re-paganizing the culture, as it were, in order to evangelize it. One of the things I found interesting is your statement about mythology. And Lewis talks about this in terms of a myth that becomes fact. And you talked about splintered light coming through the pagan myths. We're looking at scripture in which the Apostle Paul, for instance, speaks of myths in a very bad light to Timothy. Stay away from myths. How are we to understand this as Christians, particularly when we have kind of a group of Christian, pseudo-Christian wolves who would seek to appropriate myth and to say what we have in inspired scripture is myth and saga and legend, and so what's important is not the historicity of these events, not the facts, not the propositional content. What's instead important is the existential application of these universal truths. And if we hold to a Christianity that's not just speaking universally, but also very particularly, a particular people in this particular place and time, how do we make sense of navigating through that?
Well, I think we should go back to Tolkien on this, when he made it perfectly clear that Christianity was the true myth, capital T, capital M. The myth actually makes sense of all the others. So that is, if you like, the archetype. And all the other myths feed into it, because if this is the central truth of reality, it's God's truth that he's revealing, then all of these efforts before the revelation, before the Christian revelation, to try to understand reality, to try to understand God, to try to understand man's relationship with the divine, man's relationship with each other, we shouldn't be surprised if these myths point towards the Christian truth. But it's the difference is that the Christian truth is the true myth, the myth that's written by God himself and made by God himself with facts. All the others, relatively speaking, are mere shadows of it that point towards it. And I think that's something that we need to keep clear in our minds at all time. I mean, and Tolkien and Lewis were very, very stringent in making this point. And Chesterton, this sort of comparative religion nonsense that you were alluding to there, mm-hmm. Is working on the assumption that Christianity is just one amongst many myths, mm-hmm. not the one myth that makes sense of all the others, like the key that unlocks all the others. So Chesterton says that when the comparative religious people say, well, you know, there's this story of a dying and resurrecting God in various other myths, therefore, you know, that means that Christianity is not true. And Chesterton said, well, that's completely illogical. Mm-hmm. You know, because if there are stories that converge towards the Christian story, that doesn't make the Christian story less true, it makes the Christian story more true. And he said, what would we expect if there is one truth? Would we not expect that all other splintered fragments of that truth will point in the direction of it, rather than being all over the place? Mm-hmm. So, again, but the absolutely crucial distinction is we have one truth. That's the Christian truth. But because it's the one truth, it's at the center of reality. All other stories, insofar as they are true, point towards it.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as they are false, they may point away from it. But insofar as they're true, they point towards the one truth, which is the Christian truth.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you to a point. I would want to say that I think what's happening in, for instance, Romans 1 and Acts 17 is that you do have stories that are aping and mimicking and parodying the true truth. But I think we need to emphasize the rebellion against the truth that we see there, which is what I think Paul is doing at the Areopagus, for instance. You say that you believe in a God who transcends boundaries, and yet you have a temple to him. You're saying on the one hand through your pagan poets that he cannot be contained, and yet you yourselves don't believe that because you contain him or attempt to contain him. And so I think it's very important that we make clear we're not talking about Joseph Campbell. Who is saying that you have this mythical Jungian archetype that you can see in everywhere from Star Wars to Tolkien to I was just recently reading former President Bill Clinton's autobiography, and he talks about being in Haiti and seeing a woman in a voodoo trance bite the head off of a chicken. And he said, the spirit moves in mysterious ways all over the world. Well, if you can't differentiate between Christianity and a woman biting a head off of a chicken in a voodoo trance, but where we live in a world that would say that, you've got these stories, and they all are really trying to say the same thing. And so,
the essential difference between Joseph Campbell's approach to mythology and Chesterton's and Tolkien's and Lewis's and mine and yours,
mm-hmm.
I presume,
mm-hmm.
Is that Joseph Campbell talks about the archetypal myth, which is sort of feeds all of these other myths, including
mm-hmm.
Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tolkien, Lewis, and Chesterton would say Christianity is the archetypal myth,
mm-hmm.
and all the other myths only make sense in the sense that they relate to that one archetype. So the archetypal myth is the Christian truth,
mm-hmm.
whereas Joseph Campbell says the archetypal myth is some sort of thing out there which all of these things sort of feed into, some sort of nebulous, cloudy
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm. The force.
Tolkien and Lewis and Chesterton said, no, it's solid, it's incarnate, it's Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's also important to note that a lot of people define myth as non-historical.
Mm-hmm.
And when they use the term, they don't mean that. It's not, it doesn't, something can be mythological and it doesn't address whether it's historical or not. So that's why Lewis used the phrase, oh, now I understand, it's myth that became fact.
Mm-hmm.
In time and place and history, these things actually acted out. In the pagan mythologies, you have stories of dying and rising gods and corn kings and fertility and all that kind of thing. But actually, there was a time and place in history when, for one time, God actually did,
mm-hmm.
in time and space, visited, died, and rose. All the others are pale imitations through fractured, because of the noetic effects of the fall, things get distorted and perverted. But actually, it happened in one time. And so I think that's important to note. And I think one of the problems with Bultmann and a lot of these liberals, they don't understand what myth is.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been seriously and rightly criticized by people who actually understand myth. And
mm-hmm.
so you'll read the tone of frustration in people like Chesterton and Lewis when they're reading these liberal scholars, and they say, well, their first problem is they hadn't read enough myth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't taste it, feel it. They don't understand what it's all about. And they come to these kind of secular comparative religion immediate false conclusions. Another point Lewis makes, what you said yesterday in the talk at lunch brought it to mind. Lewis has a whole chapter in miracles, and he deals with a lot of this actually in miracles, these kinds of questions. But in miracles, he deals in a chapter there about metaphor and the nature of metaphor. And as he finishes the chapter, he then says, and miracles in the New Testament are emphatically not metaphor. In fact, he says, if they are poetry, they're bad poetry. In other words, because a lot of liberal scholars try to say that miracles and stuff like that, New Testament, that's some kind of poetic metaphor or something like that. And he basically says, if it is, it's bad poetry and it's bad metaphor. It isn't. It's a historical event. And, of course, the reason people reject it is simply because of the supernatural, which is another philosophical issue that they're also in error on.
Before we get completely away from talking about myths, Joseph, how are Why do you use the word myth rather than story? What's the difference between myth and story?
Well, perhaps in the sense that you might be using story, none whatsoever. I think that the key issue is that myth is something which is deep, spiritual, whereas a story, it's about what the Anglo-Saxons would call our word hoard being inadequate. That the word story can mean so many other things as well as myth. You know, you can tell a joke about an Irishman and it's a story, you know, but it isn't a myth. Mm-hmm. So really, I think because our so the thing is that I think the word myth is used to distinguish it as the certain type of story we're talking about, which is a deep story which taps into the archetype of all the deep mystical and spiritual depths of human experience, yeah, as opposed to something which is more trivial. Or a novel could be a story. I mean, a novel is not a myth. So I think it's just we need to be definite and distinct in our terms, and because story has so many different meanings, then myth at least hones it.
Right. I think some people who are not accustomed to thinking about literature, when they hear the word myth and they hear Lewis or Tolkien talk about the Christian story being the ultimate myth, that they immediately send up warning signals saying they don't think it's true, because just the average guy on the street uses the word myth to talk about something that's not true.
Well, that's why I commenced my talk yesterday by saying not facts first, truth first, and making it perfectly clear that we live, I think maybe I commenced my talk on the first talk actually, by saying that we are living in a materialistic society, in a materialistic culture that is accustomed to think that myth and lie are synonymous. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing we have to define. I mean, when I was young, I had a very infuriating friend who was older than I was, and he kept every conversation he kept insisting, well, we have to begin by defining our terms, or it depends what you mean by it. You know, when you're 19, that's incredibly infuriating. You don't want someone to say, you want to get on with the argument. But no, as I've got older, I realise that's exactly what we do have to do. So yes, I agree with you completely. So I think any discussion of myth in relation to Christianity needs to begin with defining our terms. What do we mean by myth? And emphatically, we do not mean a lie or an untruth.
Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily mean non-historical either.
No.
And that's the key way to understand that is Lewis's short little phrase, which you mentioned, myth which became fact. Mm-hmm. It's a fact that played out in the time-space continuum in history. But colloquially, when you just, people on the street, when you say myth, it means legend, it means non-historical. And not just
colloquially, but also post-Bultmann in the academy, it often used that as well.
Well, I mean, Bultmann, I mean, they understood myth wrong as well.
Right, right. Now, Jim, how would you teach through, or how do you teach through pre-Christian mythology to people from a Christian worldview? Well, what is there of value in Icelandic saga, for instance, or in Homer?
Right. Well, I have the joy of teaching these books in a seminar format, mm-hmm. and so all the students come with discussion questions, and often they're very good. But in case they don't come with any very good ones,
mm-hmm.
then I might ask a question such as, how did reading the Odyssey help you in your understanding of truth, or how has reading the Odyssey helped you in your Christianity?
Mm-hmm.
And among the many answers that may be offered, one that I would say is it reminds me before these guys did anything, they were offering sacrifices. If they were going to cross the sea, they made an offering to Poseidon. If they were going to go into battle, they would make an offering to Mars. If they were going to hunt, they would make an offering to Diana. And they realized that there were presiding deities over all of life. And the way that helps me is they're right. There is a presiding deity over every area of life. There's a presiding deity who watches over highway travel. There is a presiding deity who watches over discussion panels. And so before I drive or before I take part in a discussion panel, it makes sense that I would ask for the help of that presiding deity.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the one true and the living God?
Mm-hmm.
I would ask questions like that.
Yes. Okay. How would you go about, Professor Pierce, in terms of re-paganization, if you will? You're dealing with a deeply materialistic society. How do you even tap in to even raising these kinds of questions?
Well, that's why I used the analogy yesterday, which to taking from C.S. Lewis's The Pilgrim's Regress, about when he was talking about, this is Father History talking to John in the book, that the Jews were the people of the law, and they were concerned with the law because they knew how to read, and for them it was important. But everybody else, because they were estranged from the law, had forgotten how to read.
Mm-hmm.
So he said that the landlord, which is the word for God in The Pilgrim's Regress, the landlord sent these people pictures. And the thing is that if that's true of the pre-Christian pagans, that they'd forgotten how to read, they did not know the Judaic law, so God sent them pictures. Well, in the world in which we live, people have forgotten how to read, they've forgotten how to reason, they've forgotten about the Christian law. So the way to communicate with them is, again, through pictures. And I'll give you some example. I mean, an obvious one would be Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, that spoke directly in images to the wider world. But, I mean, I've spoken at state universities, various parts of the United States, and on the subject, Truth and Myth, Unlocking the Lord of the Rings, and 300, 350, 400 students attend. And they get essentially the same talk as I gave here. So they basically get Christianity,
mm-hmm.
Christian doctrine. And normally, six or seven people walk out as soon as they realize, but the rest will stay, and most of them not only stay, but are spellbound.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many of those people would you get to turn up if you advertised on campus, someone's coming in to talk about the truth of the gospel? You'll get your committed Christians turning up that already know about the truth of the gospel,
mm-hmm.
and they may learn something from the talk, please God. But the people that need to know about the truth of the gospel, because they don't believe, won't be there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were here for this talk on Lord of the Rings. This is a perfect example of how we can evangelize the secular culture through the power of the culture, through the power of the beauty of Christian culture. And we have 2,000 years inheritance, even if we don't include Homer and the pre-Christian stuff. We have 2,000 years of Christian art and literature and music
mm-hmm.
to evangelize the culture with. And that's why I talk about cultural apologetics and cultural evangelization. I think for people that have forgotten how to read and reason, then you have to talk to them in pictures.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm concerned about is the loss of narrative, the loss of storyline in American Christianity. That's really being reclaimed by some heretical voices. So you have those who are saying, let's reclaim narrative, let's reclaim the Christian story, who are just picking up on old liberalism. They're saying, let's do away with propositions and simply emphasize the story because it's the story of the community. Whereas I think that Orthodox Christians need to be the ones who are emphasizing the storyline, the truthfulness of the storyline. And often you have, for instance, in evangelical preaching, going through the narrative of Scripture and kind of stripping through it, trying to find these timeless propositions. So you have one set of persons standing up and taking Saul and David and stripping it away to some doctrinal content and laying that out there. And then you have some people going through stripping it through for some kind of lifestyle moralism and laying that out there. But you don't have people seeing the storyline and where they fit within the storyline. I'm just interested to know how the panel thinks we can emphasize, not only in terms of dialoguing with unbelievers, but to train up our own people to be sanctified by the storyline of Scripture and the stories that have been given to the church that are true.
Well, I should let someone else talk.
I'll let somebody else start, and then I'll join in.
I have a ready answer.
Okay.
I think you should follow the example of Boyce College and require great books. I think that would be a magnificent step.
Yeah.
Because I have heard some extraordinarily boring preaching that was orthodox
mm-hmm.
that I thought could have been cured with reading three good books.
That's exactly right.
Three good fiction books
right.
that would help them to get a feel for how this text is really answering the questions that people have been asking for thousands of years. But some of our brothers seem to have a knack, a spiritual gift for finding the most irrelevant part of the text and dwelling
right.
on it.
Right, right. And also you've got kind of an evangelical culture. Often you think of, for instance, the debate that goes on, and I'm not taking a side in this debate, but the Santa Claus debate. Sometimes you will have people say, we don't do Santa Claus in our home. And the reason for it, though, is not because we're making sure that we're keeping Christmas away from the secularization of American culture, but specifically because Santa Claus is not true. And the story is therefore dangerous because we're saying to our children something that is not true. The same thing with, you have some people who say we're not going to allow our children to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe because there's a witch in there. And there are magical things that take place. And sometimes I see kind of a reaction in conservative American Protestantism that leads to a rationalism. We want to have either a rationalism or a moralism that really is leaving us deprived. And I think you're exactly right about doing away with imagination. I think that's kind of the key element in terms of much of evangelical preaching. There's no imagination. And by that, I don't mean making things up, but I mean seeing the picture that God is putting together in the storyline of Scripture. And Flannery O'Connor would be a good antidote to some of our preachers, I really do believe.
Well, J.R.R. Tolkien said, I think in his essay on fairy stories, I think it was there, that life and nature let's get this right now. Life and nature is a vision of eternity for those so gifted. In other words, that you can see a sunrise or you can see a snowflake and see God. But you can only see God in the snow, and obviously I'm not saying you're worshipping the snowflake as God, you know, but you see in the beauty of the snowflake, the beauty of the creator of the snowflake. And that requires imagination. Mm-hmm. And imagination, say, is the imageness of God in us. It's the creativity of God in us. And I think that when we lose that, we really become Pharisaical. Mm-hmm. You know, that we know the dead letter. We're not living the Spirit. And that's something we all have to guard against. But I think imagination, always, of course, imagination in tune with orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
That should go without saying. But orthodoxy is dynamic and liberates the imagination. It doesn't stifle it. You've only got to look at, Tolkien. You look at T.S. Eliot. You look at Gerard Manley Hopkins. You look at these great Christian writers of the last 150 years, that orthodoxy liberates the imagination. It doesn't stifle it.
Mm-hmm. How would you all, with the release of the film, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, coming out in December, have not seen the film. I have no idea whether it's going to be done well or poorly. I've seen the trailer, but that's it. But there's going to be a lot of conversation there already that's already happening about Lewis. How should we kind of capitalize, for lack of a better word, on this conversation in order to think through Christian themes in Lewis at a time when you have some people saying, let's have Narnia without Aslan, or let's have Aslan, but let's have Aslan without Christ. How what's the strategy that we as Christians should take in using Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe conversation?
Well, I think one of the contributions of these Christian writers who write this various kinds of fiction is that it establishes a plausibility paradigm within the culture for Christianity. And so a lot of people who don't know the Christian story, never read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and no doubt there are many people who really just don't know the basic storyline of Jesus' life, will see that movie and be clueless.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does, this is one of the functions as a preparatio evangelium, preparation for the gospel, to set a plausibility paradigm for people within culture to where, you know, they understand these concepts that you can understand if they're faithful to the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing. And so then it's very easy to take these general concepts and then apply them in specifics. So it's, you know, so once a kid, a seven-year-old who reads the book or sees the movie and then is told the story of the Gospel of Mark, I mean, they're going to get it real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the power of literature. Ursula Le Guin wrote these children's stories, and it does the same thing for pantheism. Won all these children's stories awards and prizes. And so, basically, people understand pantheist, fundamental Buddhist and pantheistic concepts. Children understand those concepts, and they've never heard the word Buddha. and never heard Eastern pantheistic monism. But they read that children's story, and though the basic paradigm for that worldview is spelled out in a children's story, or the Star Wars, or whatever. And so the power of literature that's from a certain worldview sort of sets a kind of cultural exposure to where, when they're actually exposed more explicitly to the worldview which prompted that and produced that, doesn't seem shocking or unusual. Mm-hmm. And so we can use that to our advantage.
Mm-hmm.
In an evangelistic strategy, as a conversation starter, I think very easily. In fact, I think you'd have to work really hard not to do it,
mm-hmm.
intentionally not to do it.
I was reading something in Pascal's yesterday. It's not my usual reading, but I was reading something in Pascal yesterday when he said that the theater is an especially dangerous place for Christians to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get caught up in the story, and then it makes us especially liable to receiving the bad characteristics of the bad characters, or trying to imitate the exciting things that the characters did. And but you know what? The observation that he makes about theater that makes it dangerous also makes the power of a good story a great tool for receiving good impressions. And that's what Jim is talking about, mm-hmm. I think, is yeah. that someone may have no idea of what we mean by substitutionary atonement. But if they do the movie, like C.S. Lewis writes the book,
mm-hmm.
then they have the groundwork laid for being susceptible to thinking about that more clearly than without the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, I think Lewis's most powerful insights is when he talks in Surprised by Joy about longing and about this desire within all human beings for God, the desire that we would affirm is suppressed and is held back. But I think when you have, for instance, the White Witch sacrificing Aslan, there's a sense in which the people watching this film, even if they know nothing about Christianity, have a certain longing for this story to be true in some way. And I think that is an opportunity to at least talk about why is that, that we want a story like this to be true and to engage the issue.
Why do we want the eucatastrophe,
mm-hmm.
like you were talking about right. yesterday? Why do we want that?
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked to Professor Pierce yesterday about how Christian fiction is often so bad. And I agree. And as an evangelical Christian, I can say to you that no fiction is worse than evangelical Christian fiction. And you don't have to comment on that at all. But we've got an entire industry of taking romance novels and creating Christian romance novels where you fall in love but you don't have premarital sex and somebody gets saved before the end. And then we have the Left Behind series, and we have Christian science fiction that everybody turns out to be demons in the end, and all kinds of novels that really, as you talked about yesterday, are very, very preachy. Because the point is not the storyline. The point is getting across this particular sermonic point in the form of literature, and they sell very, very well. People read these things all over the place. How can we create a culture within Christianity that sees literature as a vocation for Christians and something that we should do? And by this, I'm thinking along the lines of Walker Percy, Flannery O'Connor, others that I happen to resonate with particularly, who don't ever necessarily write explicitly Christian themes, but they write about sin and redemption and about seeing the world as Christians would see it. How do we even go about kind of moving from Left Behind to something else?
I make one little caveat. They sell to evangelical Christians.
That's right. Oh, yes.
They don't sell to the general population.
I'm not sure that that's true, though, Dr. Parker. When you get on a, when you get on an airplane and
just
you see all of these people reading reading Left Behind.
Oh, wow.
Now, I think that's because evangelical Christians buy so many of them that they wind up on the New York Times bestseller list,
okay,
and then they get on the radar screen of other people. But you have, there was an article not long ago about the prayer of Jabez being a big phenomenon on Wall Street, where Wall Street speculators were reading the prayer of Jabez almost in the same way that they might have a rabbit's foot amulet. Or
as an amulet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm, yes.
Okay. I stand corrected. And it's on record.
Well, I've had to want to sort of address this in two ways. Chesterton, another famous thing that Chesterton said is that if a thing is worth doing at all, it's worth doing badly. And that was actually very important to me, because I was always brought up, as I'm sure many of us were, by my father telling me that if a thing's worth doing at all, it's worth doing well, which is also true. And it's a paradox that both of those statements are true.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's worth doing, it's better to do it badly than not do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously better to do it well. So, for instance, if these evangelical romances are selling in large quantities to evangelicals, it's because there's a hunger. And it's a hunger because we live in what T.S. Eliot would call a wasteland, and we need feeding. And if all that we have at the moment are the bad books, that are good books, the bad good books, then thanks be to God for the bad good books, for those that need them. I would, quite frankly, rather read Frankenstein by Mary Shelley than a bad evangelical romance. But that's, that says about me. But I want to at least start with that the thing is worth doing at all, it's worth doing badly. So if there's a hunger and people are feeding that hunger, albeit with crumbs, then so be it. But I think that the key thing is that we need to re-establish and reassert in the consciousness of Christians that creativity is a gift from God, and that you have to trust the gift. And if you're given the gift, if you have the talent to write or to compose music or to play music or to paint, then you have to, A, that's a calling, that's a vocation, that's an apostolate, so you should do it. But B, trust in the power of the Spirit that's coming through that grace, and work with it. Don't try to dominate it. Don't say that I want to make this point. I had an argument with somebody last night, and they're so wrong. I'm going to write a book about it. I'm going to write a novel where the point of it at the end is saying ha ha to you, you know. And so that's going to be a bad book, you know. But if something stirs in your imagination, wherever the imagination is, if something stirs in the imagination, it's probably because a gift's been given, and that initial inspiration, you should just go with it, and then let the thing flow out. Afterwards, as Tolkien said, that Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously so at first, consciously in the revision. Then, don't make the mistake I did, by the way, you write a novel in the stream of consciousness, some foolhardy publisher offers to publish it, you say, hey, and it's published, and then you wish it hadn't been, because you should have sat in it for 3 years and gone back and had a look at it when you'd matured a bit. So again, go with the flow, let it come out with the inspiration, and then put it down for a little while, come back, have a look at it, and hone it then. Then work at it, and the inspiration will still be coming through when you're working for it. You won't be left deserted.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you'll have something which is a genuine work of literature rather than a piece of trash fiction. Please God.
I would like for you to comment on something that I perceive was very useful in the life of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien in their writing such quality work and so much of it. And that's the Inklings group. It seems to me that there are very few of us in America, I don't know how it is in other places, there are very few of us who have a group of buddies that we get together with once a week to read things that we've written. And it was, I was just reading in Tolkien's letters this morning in preparation for this and thinking about it, how that he, essentially the Lord of the Rings was kind of a self-assignment that he had with C.S. Lewis, that C.S. Lewis would write a space thing, and he would write a, I forget what he called it.
Time travel.
Yeah,
time. It wasn't Lord of the Rings. It was another story. But
oh,
yeah,
was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Points.
But the point about the Inklings is a very, very important one. And in fact, we were talking about exactly the same thing yesterday. We went out for dinner with two faculty members last night, and it was the exact thing that was being complained about. Is no one ever gets together to actually to talk and spark ideas off each other and to act as a catalyst as a group, as the Inklings did. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that on a campus like this, you know, at Ave Maria, there's some students who got together and they formed a poetry club where they both recite good classic poetry, but they also recite their own poetry and encourage each other. I think that these literary circles are very important, and I think they should be encouraged. And having kindred spirits that are trying to do the same thing as you're doing, maybe doing it better, but then that can inspire you and teach you. And, you know, I think that's absolutely crucial. And I think a university campus or a seminary campus like this is an ideal place for groups like that to really flourish. And if they're not flourishing, then perhaps that's a question the institution wants to be asking itself as to why are they not flourishing. Is this a problem we need to address?
How about we talked about the influence of Lewis and Tolkien on creating quality literature, literature that speaks to the human spirit. And we talked a little bit about bad, good books. But and perhaps an even bigger issue, especially for parents who are Christians, is the issue of good, bad books. So how do we deal with, for instance, Philip Pullman and these novels that are of quite good quality, unevenly so, but of quite good quality, but they are explicitly anti-Christ, anti-Christian, and others that perhaps aren't that explicit. And especially when you have children, older children, reading these works who perhaps aren't discerning enough. How do we equip the church, and specifically parents, to help find literature that will feed a Christian imagination rather than to feed it off of it?
Well, there's two things there. I want to address the issue of creativity here, because there are obvious questions that some people may be asking and probably should be asking when you talk about someone like Philip Pullman, is, you know, that if you say that creativity is a gift of God, and how on earth is stuff like Philip Pullman being written that's mm-hmm. good-ish as literature, mm-hmm. That why is that? And what I tell my students is that it's the gift of creativity is the same as the gift of life, that God gives us all different talents. And he doesn't take that gift away because we use it badly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gives us the gift of life, and we can abuse that gift. And, of course, you know, God, we're in trouble at the end of our life if we haven't learned before the end of our life. And it's the same thing with creativity. If God gives us that gift, he is going to give us the freedom to abuse or use that gift. Of course, we're answerable to that at the judgment. Mm-hmm. And if we're given great gifts from God and we squander them, we throw our pearls to swine, cast our pearls before swine, then we're answerable. So that I wanted to address that issue, because the point is that the gift that Philip Pullman has is a gift from God,
mm-hmm.
but he's taken it to himself, Smaug-like, you know, as if the gift is a ring, it's his possession,
mm-hmm.
rather than seeing it as a gift to basically give back to the giver,
mm-hmm.
in glory and creativity. But as regards how we protect our children from good, bad books, is that we need to reinvigorate the Christian imagination, particularly in the sense of the great works of literature that are already out there. That, you know, please God, there will be a new Christian cultural revival in the 21st century as there was in the 19th and 20th century. Please God, there will be. So there'll be lots of good, new books.
Mm-hmm.
But if in the absence of many good, new books, there are many, many good, old books. And I think that the issue is education. Make sure that we can reinvigorate the imagination of Christian parents to see that the absolute abundance of good literature out there to feed their children with and to feed themselves with.
Mm-hmm.